Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Motorsports Unplugged. This is the one place where you'll find your racing fix. Unfiltered, unbiased, and of course, unplugged. Welcome to Hell on Wheels. And now your host, Michelle Rahal.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Michelle Rahal. This is Motorsports Unplugged. We welcome you back. Happy New Year to everyone. I am joined by Bill Marlowe and Gene Boyer, and this is a one-hour race around the auto racing issues of the week. But actually, it's about what is coming down the pike, because we're about to go racing again. That's the one thing I love about getting rid of the holidays, is here we go racing again. And here are the topics we're going to go over tonight. It's going to be NASCAR. What are the rule changes for 2015? What do they mean? What do they actually mean? And we're going to enlist Bill Marlowe, who is the NASCAR expert. He is expert on other forms of racing, trust me. But NASCAR, he is truly an insider. And next is going to be F1. We're going to talk about Honda. Honda is trying to get the FIA to reconsider what's known as the unfreeze. In other words, they want to be able to develop their engine as well as Ferrari and Renault to be able to catch up with Mercedes. We're going to talk about that and let you in on how that's going. Also, the breaking news, sort of breaking news, I would consider it. We knew it was coming towards us, but by 2017, Formula One wants to have 1,000 horsepower cars. That is a 300 horsepower increase, wider tires, do away with the fuel mileage. I'm all for it. I think we're going to see that happen. By 2017, it'll be staged in. And in sports cars, you got to start following sports cars, ladies and gentlemen, because it is a growing segment of the racing industry, especially in the United States and especially in the prototype series. The new LMP3 class is looking stronger and stronger by the day. So we're going to kick it off with NASCAR. The NASCAR, the rule changes for 2015. Now, Bill, you said that there would be no changes for Daytona and Talladega. Those two tracks, obviously restrictor plate tracks, different sort of racing. But we're going to have engines with less horsepower, less downforce. What does this mean? Who's going to benefit? Who's going to struggle? Just start the conversation. Tell us what you know, and Gene and I will dive in with questions.
Thanks, Michelle. First off, at Daytona and Talladega, they're going to keep the existing car package, the engine aero package. That's working well. It's always been completely different from the other tracks. This year in 2015, NASCAR, Goodyear, and the teams have been working towards the last part of 2014 to come up with a new, more competitive car package so that we can see more driver interreaction. One thing that they're going to do is reduce the rear spoiler size from 7.25 inches, where it is now, to 6 inches. This is going to take about 300 pounds of downforce off the rear of the car. 300 pounds of downforce is about one-third of what's back there right now. So we're going to see a much more difficult car to drive. Not everybody's just going to be able to drive it in the corner, sustain really high cornering speeds. And because of the extra aero grip, not really worry about the car getting away from them. That's the way it has been up through 2014. 2015, that's all going to go away. That extra grip's going to disappear. It's going to be back racing like it was years ago, and we're going to see the difference between the drivers who got the magic feel and those drivers who do not have that magic feel.
The second thing we've got going on is who are those drivers going to be? It's the people that have the car control, I would assume, the Carl Edwards of the world. And I don't know about Jimmy Johnson. I mean, if you stop and think about it, I mean, Johnson's...
Jimmy Johnson's on my list, but I've got a big question mark beside him. They kind of lost their way in 2014. You know, they increased the roll to the cars, and they just never were a factor. And towards the end of the season, Chad Knaus, Jimmy's crew chief, and Jimmy had some knockout, drag-out verbal arguments over the radio. And they can't help but be damaging. You know, I've always kind of thought that Chad Kanas is the kind of crew chief that he really thinks he's more important than the driver when it comes down to it. And I'm not so sure that at one time he didn't try to get in the car and drive it doing a test to show Johnson that he could get the job done. That kind of backfired, I believe. But the two guys that I think that are going to continue to shine are going to be Kevin Harvick and Brad Keselowski. Both of these have great car control, and I expect to see them to be at the front of the pack at every race. The guys that I think that have not performed so well and we've kind of forgotten about who are going to come to the front, number one, Casey Kane. Casey Kane's a dirt track sprint car driver, superb. Of course, you know, I was his engineer for a number of years. He's got superb car control. And I think Casey's going to be at the front of the pack, too, and a real player throughout the year. Kyle Busch, who, again, I think the Toyota lost a step doing 2014. But with the rules change, I strongly suspect we're going to see Kyle Busch driving up to the front. And for a long time, I thought Kyle Busch was the best wheel man out there. When it comes down to car control, he's got it. Now, again, he's got a new crew chief. He ran into problems with his, and they've got a new rookie guy coming on board. But Kyle Busch is a wheel man, and he'll get the job done. The two sleepers that remain on my list is Kyle Larson. We know that he's a dirt track driver. We've seen all year he's run a number of seconds. He just can't figure out how to win in the last 10 laps. But we've seen a number of seconds, and we've seen him drive the wheels off the car. When it comes to less,
he's driven everything. He's driven sports cars. He's driven open wheel. He's driven the sprint cars, the regular sprint cars, and he's driven the cup cars. So he's got a wealth of experience for his age.
Yeah, I think later on when we talk about sports cars, I think Ganassi's got him penciled in as a seat in one of the DP cars at the 24 Hours later on this month. The last driver I got on my list is Ryan Blaney. Ryan Blaney's a dirt track driver. I think he's a superstar coming along, and he'll be driving the Woods car. And the difference this year is the Woods do not have a technical alliance with Roush Fenway Motorsports. They now have a technical alliance with Penske Motorsports. Penske Racing might really make a difference in the Wood Brothers' performance. And they've got a top-notch driver. They brought along one of their own crew chiefs. I'm expecting big things to happen with the Wood Brothers and Ryan Blaney this coming year. And really kind of interested in what Gene has to say about this.
Well, good evening, fellas. Happy New Year to you. Really, really happy to be back on the air with you guys. You know, I'm sitting here and I'm listening to this and I'm making a little list of my own. Going to be real interesting for me to see, assuming that Tony Stewart is healthy this year and puts these legal issues behind him. We know he lives for the dirt track, and that was the first driver that jumped off the page at me as somebody who this might. He's always competitive. He wins races every year. He can threaten for a championship, but I mean, this is a guy who, you know, spends his off days at a dirt track, either one he owns or at another track in a car that he owns, driving with one of the teams he owns. So that's going to be for me to be the real guy to watch this year. He's had an off season to deal with whatever legal issues he's got going on, and that's going to be fun for me to watch. As you guys know, you know, NASCAR is not my favorite form of racing. But I will tell you, I think it's going to be real fun to see these new cars with the new aero package running at Charlotte and places like that where you're hitting 190 miles an hour going down the straightaway. I imagine that first turn is going to look a whole lot different with 300 pounds less downforce on it. What do you think, Michelle?
Yeah, well, I think what's going to happen is you've got the young drivers who are not so set in their methodology of driving that they're able to adapt quickly. I mean, that's what happens to drivers who get stuck. They can win 5 Formula Ford championships, and then they jump into a Formula Atlantic, and the best they can do is an 8th place. they get stuck in a particular discipline. So these young drivers who are moving quickly, I think that these young drivers, I'm with Bill, I think Larson, I think Blaney, I think Elliott, Chase Elliott, those guys, I think those are the guys that we're going to see if, and I do believe everything that Bill has said about the engineering side of this, I think these guys are going to adapt very quickly.
You know, one thing, Michelle and Gene, they're reducing the horsepower, taking about 125, 150 horsepower away. And a lot of people are saying, well, this is going to hurt the racing. It's going to slow down the cars. Keep in mind, when you reduce that blade, it's what we call the rear appendage, the rear spoiler. On the teams, we refer to it as a blade. When you reduce the size of that blade and take it out of the wind, you pick up speed. So we're going to see a speed from reducing the blade size, and it might just very well offset the reduction in horsepower.
Well, it's going to be interesting, Bill, in my mind, and you do make that very good point. You do pick up that speed, dropping that blade on the rear, but you also pick up that lack of stability at the back of the car as you go in. So I think oversteer becomes a much bigger factor. And like you say, these young kids who, let's face it, the older you get, the more you think about what happens if you don't make it out the other side of turn two or turn four. So, you know, when you're 21 years old and don't believe you can die and you got fast reflexes and you've got good equipment underneath you, it's going to be I might find myself sitting, tuning in to a few more of these races this year, because it just sounds like this package is going to make for some exciting racing. Going to be hell on those teams back in the shop, though, because it sounds to me like there's going to be a lot of sheet metal getting torn up.
Well, you know, one thing that I just thought about is this year they also are going to have an adjustable roll bar in the driver's cockpit.
We've had
adjustable brake lights before, and that doesn't always go so well. Try not to let your drivers adjust anything if we can help it, because often they go the wrong way. So our listeners that have scanners at the track side or have the broadcast with the driver's frequencies sometimes displayed or played back over the air might get in, listen to some real arguments between crew chiefs and drivers when they suggest a roll bar change. The driver executes it and it doesn't go well. You know, the first thing the crew chief's going to say is he went the wrong way. The driver, if he changes it, he's gonna reverse it, or if it helps it, he's going to cheat. He's going to turn it a little bit more and then take it out of that window. So I expect to see some pretty exciting discussions over the air on the team frequencies during races, especially when they start letting the drivers initially start moving these roll bar settings.
Hey, Bill, help a NASCAR novice out here. Exactly what does that roll bar do, and how does it affect the handling of the car?
The rear roll bar determines how the rear axle is attached to the frame, and basically you can adjust it up and down. What you do is you move one physical locating point up and down, and that effectively changes the roll center. You can raise or lower the roll center to offset whatever bad tendencies the car is exhibiting at that point in time.
It softens.
So that would affect how it rolls through the turn then.
Right, but it'll soften. Or it's like if you were in Formula One or any Formula car, you're racing in the rain, we used to disconnect the roll bars altogether so the car would roll and be more forgiving. In other words, a very stiff car, you could stiffen or soften the car with the roll bars. Sway bars, people call them. They're roll bars. In the Atlantics, and Bill, I don't know if the Atlantics you drove, you had front and rear adjustable sway bars where you could do it from the cockpit, correct?
Yeah, we had roll bars in the open wheel cars. In the NASCAR, we're actually talking about a track bar, which is securing the axle. It secures the axle to the frame. Without that, it would roll away from the frame. But in securing it, they have an adjustable feature on one end that you can crank up and down, and this effectively raises and lowers the roll center of the rear of the car.
But they don't have anything on the front, do they? I mean, there's nothing on the front that they can do to, I mean, like we had adjustable front and rear, but they don't. They just have an adjustable rear. Is that the deal for NASCAR?
Yeah, and they have a true sway bar on the front most of the time. Yeah. Sometimes they've chosen not to run it, but most of the time they all have a sway bar up front. Of course, on these NASCAR, the true thing is to get the springs right, and, you know, they got a different spring rate in every corner. The only adjustable feature they have, and that's what we're talking about, is what the driver can do during the course of the race that he's not had a choice to do before, is to adjust that rear track bar. If I said roll bar before, I apologize. It's a track bar, and it actually does a different function than what a sway bar does, a sway bar or a roll bar does.
Can you imagine what the F1 drivers, I mean, and we've all looked at the steering wheels of these new F1 cars, all of the buttons, all of the adjustments, all of the, I mean, they're totally adjustable from engine mapping to roll center, to brake bias, to just, you name it. I mean, it's like all over the steering wheel. And in NASCAR, the speed is so high and sustained, it seems like the less that they have to deal with, the better. In F1, I mean, we obviously want more.
I think we saw this year doing practice, a couple of the F1 drivers drive off the track while they were playing with their steering wheel adjustments.
That's right.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. Can you imagine that in a $30 million car?
Well, you saw what you saw, Keke Rosberg. I mean, not Keke. Listen to me. I'm dating myself now. And you saw Nico Rosberg going into the first turn at the start of the. And I don't think it was. I can't remember whether it was Abu Dhabi or not. And he's going into the first turn. He's got Hamilton, but he reaches up and makes an adjustment just before he hits the brakes at 180 miles an hour, and then goes off. You know, goes sliding or off. And Hamilton gets around. So there is that point in time where there is just too much to do at such a sustained speed on such a finite course. Airplanes are different. You have, unless you're approaching the ground at a rapid speed, but airplanes are different. I mean, airplanes, you've got the that infinite space. Automobiles, you don't. You have a very finite amount of room to be able to operate your equipment, so the less you have to do, the better from a driver's point of view, I suppose. But the driver always wants more, wants to be able to adjust the car more. My curiosity is just in how this will affect the short tracks. How do you think that these changes are going to affect the short tracks?
The short tracks will be very dramatic also. Bristol, Dover Mile is going to be really interesting. But, yeah, it's going to be – these changes are going to carry over from the shortest half-mile track all the way up to the two-mile tracks that we run at Michigan and in California. Taking that 300 pounds of downforce off the rear is going to make the difference between these cars feeling very comfortable versus feeling very, very, very loose to get through a corner.
Hey, Bill, let me ask you a question. That difference in the downforce at the rear of the car, as a layperson, it would seem to me that that would be a much more profound difference from a feeling standpoint in the cockpit on a speedway or on a mile and a half oval. Is it noticeable? Is it significant on the short tracks? And if so, how does it differ from the larger tracks?
It's very much the same thing, Gene. It's just harder to catch the faster you go. But the coefficient of friction, the amount of grip that you have from the car to the track is diminishing. And once you exceed that grip level, you're going to lose the rear of the car. If you can catch it quick enough with the steering and throttle, that works out. But you're losing time when you do that stuff. The guys that can drive the quickest are able to hang that rear end out and drive it right on the edge, where actually the rear end is slipping a little bit more to the side than the front end, what we call a loose or free condition.
Sure.
And if we could run along, if we could drive beside one of these guys, Gene, and you're in the passenger side and could reach out, you could actually push their car away from us in the corner because it's got no grip. It's just like a slippery surface. You can actually reach out. You exerted 2 or 3 pounds, you could push that car away from you. That's why when you see these cars going down the straightaway in corners at Talladega and Daytona, it looks like the rear's bouncing around, dancing around, you know, 6 inches, 8 inches. Well, it really is, and the reason it's doing that is it doesn't have grip.
Well, you know, I'm sure you know, you guys probably both know, Norm Benning is a longtime journeyman driver. I think he's retired now, but he's from my hometown. And I was at a barbecue one Saturday, and Norm was describing what it's like to drive at Daytona. And when he told me that going down that straightaway before they resurfaced that track, you were literally airborne going the whole way down the track. The car bounced down the track. It kind of drove home that, man, this, it looks like they're glued to the track and driving on rails, and it's, the reality is anything but. So that's very interesting.
All right, guys, we're going to take a break now and for a couple of minutes, and we'll be right back on the other side. We're going to talk some F1. There's a lot to talk about there, too. And so give us just a minute, and we'll come back with Gene Boyer and Michelle Rahal and Bill Marlow. See you on the other side.
Hi, this is Michelle Rahal, and you've been listening to Motorsports Unplugged Radio. But did you know that we have a website with world-class automotive writers, including Steve Wade, our editor-in-chief and Motorsports Hall of Fame winner for journalism? We deliver opinions and editorials you won't find anywhere else. From Formula One to NASCAR to IndyCar and sports car racing, www.motorsportsunplugged.com, your online destination from the real insiders. Also, take a look at www.thedrivechannel.com, where you'll see automobiles of all kinds, exotic, supercars, unique cars. We produce review videos and commentary that involves one thing we all love, cars. With 7 million views and over 200 videos, stop by and become a Drive Channel fan today. That's www.thedrivechannel.com, and coming soon, a full website with written commentary and opinions on everything automotive. Stop by and see us. Do you love shooting firearms? Are you one of the millions who enjoy shooting sports? If you are, we want you to go to www.theshootingchannel.com for your firearms fix. New models, reviews, and commentary by some of the firearm world's best writers. If you're a legal gun owner or want to be, the Shooting Channel is for you. From home and self-defense to hunting and target shooting, seasoned pro, or if you're new at it. If it's about shooting, it's at www.theshootingchannel.com. And stay tuned for the Shooting Channel radio show coming soon. And now, back to Motorsports Unplugged with Gene Boyer, Michelle Rahal, and Bill Marlow.
Welcome back to Motorsports Unplugged. I'm Michelle Rahal, along with Bill Marlow and Gene Boyer. And we had been talking about NASCAR and the rule changes, who might be affected, who might not, what drivers we might see come to the front or shine, so to speak. In 2015, and now we're going to switch a little bit to Formula One. In Formula One, the biggest news, I mean, obviously the last show we did, it was, the big news was that Jenson Button was named to drive with McLaren, and McLaren is taking on the new engine manufacturer coming into the game, Honda. Well, the deal is this. When they started with these new power plants, which are a combination of a gasoline-powered engine and a very high-powered electric-style engine, what it did was it just completely changed the game. They didn't want to allow, they wanted everyone to what's known as homologate or declare, this is my engine, and they wanted to do that before they started testing. And they were only allowed to make certain changes during the year. Well, Honda sat a year out. Mercedes and McLaren actually had a contract that had not run out. So Honda stayed a year out. Now what's happened is they have allowed, the FIA has allowed engine changes during the season. They're able to develop these engines during the season for Ferrari, Mercedes, and Renault. but they have decreed that Honda will not be allowed to change their engine during the season because they're a new manufacturer. Now, Honda is protesting that, and they're going back to appeal it. They don't think the general idea is they're not going to win it because they did get the advantage of sitting a year out, watching what everybody else did, and taking advantage of it and building their motor. But they do have the right to protest virtually every single race during the season, no matter what happens, unless they're winning everything, of course, and we kind of know that's not going to happen. But they will be able to protest every single race because each development that is put in place by any of the manufacturers, they can immediately protest that. So they've still got that right. That's a bargaining chip going into the next round of meetings they're having with the FIA over whether or not Honda can develop in season with the rest of the manufacturers. I was torn on this. Bill and I have gone back and forth about it a bit, but I'm beginning to lean more towards Bill's point of view. And Bill, give him your point of view, and then I'll pop back in.
I think that Honda's had a year and a half to develop that engine. What's more important is that McLaren has had that Mercedes engine in their hands 24/7 for over a year now. You know that they have shared everything that they can glean from that Mercedes engine, hands-on measurements, engine dyno data, chassis dyno data, probably taking parts of the engine apart with the Honda people there looking and measuring and taking pictures and photos of it.
It wouldn't be the first time. They were fined $100 million for stealing Ferrari secrets, 5 years ago?
Exactly. Let me ask you a question. Let's just say that Gene there, he's the the Renault engine guy. Michelle, you're the Ferrari engine guy. Would you have any qualms about if I was the Honda guy, about I might have a little edge at the end of a year and a half, and you knew that I had been running a Mercedes engine? I mean, where is that thing at when it's not at the race? It's at the factory or in a transport? Who knows where it's at? It might be in
Japan. Tokyo. And it probably should
be. You need to worst of my for the worst. You know,
just so they couldn't get caught. Formula One it is so Machiavellian, it truly makes NASCAR look like the Cub Scouts. There's so much money
Absolutely.
In it. There's no telling what these guys have done. I think you're absolutely right. I think Honda has got to pay a price for the year and a half. Because I think you're right.
You know, Michelle, I've never seen Honda come out of the box with a bad motor. I mean, if you look at their racing record, it's always been a winning record. I think some of this teething problems we've seen for photo op days are just that, a photo opportunity to throw the rest of the guys off the scent. When they get down to it, I'll bet you they are very competitive. And I'm not so sure the engine might not have more power than the Mercedes. So much so, you know, in our conversation, Michelle, I've told you, I think that Honda engine may blow up because it may be a grenade. They certainly have realized the problems with the RPM that the other guys didn't have. The other guys designed an engine that was supposed to turn like 2,000, 3,000 RPM more than they could really turn it because of the fuel flow. Honda now realizes that, and when they design their engine and their cams and their piston and their flame propagation across the piston heads, they know how much fuel is going to go through that, and they're going to have a more efficient engine, which results in more horsepower at the bottom line.
Great answer.
Well, I can tell you guys, as I watched this thing go, and I think you're absolutely right, Honda was under no I don't for a second think that they have not been developing an engine for the last year and a half. That said, Mercedes threw $500 million developing this hybrid unit. So I don't feel sorry for any of these guys. I'm of a mindset that
with all your points as valid as they are, Bill, I'm kind of a mindset, these are billionaires. You don't get to be a billionaire by playing fair unless you're born into it. You can make the argument that that's not fair. I don't think any of these guys are at any kind of a disadvantage. And they collect a tremendous amount of data while they're racing these cars. So not having looked into it to the depth that you guys have, my takeaway is whatever Honda did on their own, I don't for a second think the Mercedes and Ferrari and the rest of them weren't doing on the track to one extent or another. So I'd be fine seeing Honda be
Mercedes to
develop their engine.
The new Mercedes engine, the new one they're coming out with, everybody's saying right now it's probably 60 to 70 horsepower more than last year's. So they've learned
right.
a lot themselves. It's just the
right.
the system of upgrading these engines is absurd. It's almost some socialist system of tokens, you know, of food stamps for engines, you know, for billionaires. I mean, that's almost what it's like. We'll trade you this much, these many tokens of development for that many tokens of development. It really is confusing to the layman. And all the layman really cares about is where it's headed, and where it's headed is the next subject, I think. And that is that by 2017, they want to have 1,000 horsepower cars. Right now, they're bouncing around 700 horsepower. They want to have 1,000 horsepower cars by 2017. I think it'll come in stages. They've already talked about wider tires for 2016 and an upgrade in horsepower for 2016. So 2015 is going to be God knows what's going to happen. I'm with Bill and I'm with you. Who knows about Honda? Honda, I mean, that was a fantastic explanation, by the way, Bill, of what Honda is capable of doing by just watching and being able to gather information from, you know, an oncoming foe, being Mercedes. So the changes that I think are going to be made are going to be done in steps. Again, an upgrade in the engine's horsepower in 2016, and they're talking about the wider tires. I know you, Bill, you and I have gone back and forth about why increase the size of the tires, but if you get to 1,000 horsepower and you use the same size tires you've got now, I don't think they could barely make it down a straightaway without spinning those tires. You'd never get full throttle. So I think with the wider tires, the cars are going to be obviously faster, probably faster than they've ever been. And it will be, I think, if they will follow, if whoever the manufacturer is will clamp down and just give them one compound to run through the race, but two, you got to change tires, but give them one compound instead, you know, for each track, but do like I think what NASCAR does. I think NASCAR picks a compound for the track, and that's the compound you got to run. Am I correct?
That's correct. They
okay.
only have one compound, and Goodyear picks the compound.
Right.
Goodyear has complete safety. It's a safety deal. And when they race, if all three touring series are at the same track, like Daytona, all three touring series use the same compound. There is a difference, Michelle, between left and right. Sometimes the left side is softer
yeah.
than the right side.
Yeah. But I think with the wider tires, if they just pick one compound that they've got to run for that weekend on that particular track, and they're, you know, they have to make a tire change, instead of the soft
only to reason they put in that soft compound is to get a qualifying lap in. Usually that soft compound, an F1, the soft compound, I want to be clear, this is an F1 I'm talking about. That soft compound
yeah.
is for qualifying, and
yeah.
usually it's just good for one lap. What a waste.
And qualifying
yeah.
engines. But now yeah. they have to change during the race. They have to run softs, which are good for maybe 10
well, yeah.
laps.
Soft tire, that was for maybe with 5 laps to go, a guy might put on a soft tire to try to catch up if he had a deficiency, you know, between the leader. But, again, I still think that soft tire is primarily to get a quick qualifying lap in. But I'm with you, Michelle. Do away with it. Just bring one compound. And, do a change. Do two tire changes if need be. And the size of the tire, let Pirelli or Michelin, whoever is the current supplier of tires to F1, work with at least two, maybe three of the teams. In fact, it would be fair to work with one team with each engine, and they can determine what would be the optimum tire size to handle the horsepower and corner speeds. You got to balance the front and back.
Yeah. I mean, the chassis actually starts with the tire. I mean, it's the chassis that is built based upon the tire. Am I correct?
I think you actually start with the power. You determine how much power you're going to put down, and that leads you down the road to what size tire you're going to have. In other
right.
words, if you got a bridge right now, you wouldn't have a clue, you know, if you started on the back end. You got to start with the power to the wheels, to the drive wheels, and then you build your tire based on that.
Well, I mean, I've got, you know, I'm agnostic in terms of drivers in all the series pretty much. I have some sentimental favorites. Obviously, Alonso is mine, and he is going to be running a Honda-powered car with McLaren. And Gene is Lewis Hamilton with Mercedes. So I see where, you know, he's coming from.
You know, my gosh, should I sing happy birthday to him? He turned 30.
No, there's no need. There's no need for that. You don't want to become a fan, you know, an Uber fan. You got to just take it like it is. I mean, it's auto racing. If it's a sixth place car, he can take it to third. So he's one, you know, he's generally considered the top driver in F1, but not if Honda doesn't, and Honda and McLaren, if Honda and McLaren don't put together the right package, he's going to be fighting the same battle. Here's one thing that I want to throw out there. Raikkonen, Ferrari's engineer, said, you know, ex-engineer, said Raikkonen can only really drive the car when it's perfect for him. Alonso can drive, he can adapt quickly to whatever the situation is. Well, you know what? Now Ferrari's got two drivers who seem to be exactly the same. It seems as if Sebastian Vettel could not adapt to the changes that were made for these new power plants. And I'm wondering if you've got two drivers that require almost perfection on the way those cars are set up, what's Ferrari going to look like next year?
Well, I agree with you, Michelle. It looks like the perfect pair over at Ferrari with Vettel and Kimi Raikkonen. They both like cars that have sensitive front ends. And, you know, Kimi beat Alonso back in 2013 with the Lotus. That boy can drive. I'm not sure there's that much difference between Alonso and Kimi at the end of the day. They're both very, very talented people. And I think that if Ferrari can get their engineering in order and get that front end working, we're going to see a chance to finish better. Of course, you know, I don't know where their engine program is. I suspect that that's still 2 years away, or an engine rules change down the road before they really become competitive. I think the best game we can hope for next year is the Honda engine cars versus the Mercedes cars.
All right,
race and a B race.
We're going to go ahead and take a little break here, and on the other side, we're going to probably talk more, a little bit more maybe about Formula One, but we also want to pay some homage to the sports car side of things, which seems to be growing in the United States and worldwide, and some of our friends are involved in that, and you know, we're quite proud of them, and just happy to see the prototypes and things come back. I'm Michelle Rahal. This is Motorsports.com, Motorsports Radio. We'll be back on the other side of the break. See you then. Hi, this is Michelle Rahal, and you've been listening to Motorsports Unplugged Radio. But did you know that we have a website with world-class automotive writers, including Steve Wade, our editor-in-chief and Motorsports Hall of Fame winner for journalism? We deliver opinions and editorials you won't find anywhere else. From Formula One to NASCAR to IndyCar and sports car racing, www.motorsportsunplugged.com, your online destination from the real insiders.
Also, take a look at www.thedrivechannel.com, where you'll see automobiles of all kinds, exotic, supercars, unique cars. We produce review videos and commentary that involves one thing we all love, cars. With 7 million views and over 200 videos, stop by and become a Drive Channel fan today. That's www.thedrivechannel.com, and coming soon, a full website with written commentary and opinions on everything automotive. Stop by and see us. Do you love shooting firearms? Are you one of the millions who enjoy shooting sports? If you are, we want you to go to www.theshootingchannel.com for your firearms fix. New models, reviews, and commentary by some of the firearm world's best writers. If you're a legal gun owner or want to be, the Shooting Channel is for you. From home and self-defense to hunting and target shooting, seasoned pro, or if you're new at it. If it's about shooting, it's at www.theshootingchannel.com. And stay tuned for the Shooting Channel radio show coming soon. And now, back to Motorsports Unplugged with Gene Boyer, Michelle Rahal, and Bill Marlowe. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Michelle Rahal. This is Motorsports Unplugged. I'm joined by Bill Marlowe and Gene Boyer. We were talking about Formula One, and in particular, the movement towards higher horsepower, wider tires. It seems to me that they're going to have to do something, because Formula One is in disarray right now, despite Bernie Ecclestone's comments that everything is fine, we can run with 16 cars, big deal. Well, it is a big deal. People want to see 20 cars on that grid, and they want to see 20 cars that really seem to be going for it. And so far, that hasn't happened. Now, here's an interesting one. Gene Haas, who is one of the owners of Stuart Haas Racing, has Haas Formula One. We know that. What he's done is right now, he's hiring people for his United Kingdom shop. He is making hints that there is actually some sort of a deal brewing where there may be customer chassis available. Now, I find that hard to believe, but he seems to have, or he is acting as if he has Ecclestone's ear. Now, I'm not sure that this is, even if it's even possible. It's been so long since they've had customer cars in Formula One, I don't see how they could handle it. But what are your thoughts on the subject, Bill?
Well, you know, it hadn't been that long ago. Toro Rosso used Red Bull chassis until they came up with a rule saying that each team had to be a quasi-manufacturer.
That's
but
right.
That's only been like 3 or 4 years. So,
I
think I can see what they're saying. You know, if we have Ferrari and Red Bull, Mercedes selling chassis to these guys, it provides some income to them and make these other guys a little bit more competitive. You can give them the chassis. If they don't have the same horsepower, they're not going to beat you. Well, you know what? Schumacher with the Benetton, he was able to beat the big teams.
That's right.
With his driving prowess back there in the day, and that's what brought them along. I would like to see it go in the direction. What they've got now is not working. Gene Haas is 100% correct. The little guy can't
agree.
Be a manufacturer. You know, if Gene would come off the hip and give us some money, you and I could, you know, run him in F2000 or Formula Ford, have a lot of fun, might even be competitive with him if he can drive as good as he talks. But, you know, if we were going to hurry all this go to the moon, it's going to happen. And, you know, the guys working on these F1 cars, guess what? They're engineers that actually worked on space stuff. If they can't get these cars to run with this trick hybrid system, the little guy just doesn't stand a chance. And Gene Haas is a little guy. Believe me, he might have a pretty big pocketbook to us, but he's a little guy in the F1 world. And,
sure.
It's only a few of those guys go around. They're having too much trouble getting these cars to run. The one thing I'd like to add, Michelle, is whatever they do, if they do 1,000 horsepower, if they do the wheels, whatever, they got to bring the noise back. They got to bring that
absolutely
exciting noise. That's what race cars are all about.
That was brought up in the meeting, by the way, in the 1,000 horsepower discussion and the decision to do that. That was brought up, the sound. And that is going to be addressed in the next meeting. So
you know, it's a meeting after meeting after meeting. It sounds like the Lithuanian parliament. You know, I mean, it just goes on forever. But they are talking about the sound as well. So we'll see what happens. But if Haas, you know, Ferrari has not disputed anything Haas has said so far. I find that unusual because Ferrari, trust me, Ferrari is heavy-handed. It took me 2 years to get a media credential from Ferrari. And that is, and it didn't take 2 weeks from Mercedes or anybody else. But Ferrari, they protect that brand with their lives. And North America is very important to them. They don't trust China. They don't trust that market. It may very well be a market that for their road cars, you know, that is a bubble and is good for now. But the big money is still Europe and the United States. And I think Haas to them somehow represents a foothold in the United States. Their road cars, the road cars aren't going anywhere. But obviously, Marchionne from Fiat, who runs it all, he is very interested in bringing and raising the level of awareness of F1 in the United States. But so far, Ferrari has said nothing to contradict what Haas has said. I find that odd. How about you?
A few years ago, they had a quarry between the manufacturers, and Ferrari said they were going to quit F1 and go sports car racing.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, they stayed in F1. About 3 years after that dilemma, we found out that Ferrari's contract with the FIA was different from the other manufacturers, and they had different voting, different money coming to them. They could structure a situation under the table where they had a veto that the other teams didn't have. If I remember correctly, Michelle, you
probably... No, you're absolutely correct. Ferrari is the only one that has veto power in those in that situation. If is that not
so, we might see Gene Haas a mouthpiece for Ferrari publicly, but in the background, I'm sure that Ferrari is that their executives have an inside track. They probably got a red telephone that rings on Bernie's desk. You know, it probably lights up at all hours of the day. I'm sure that they've got a hotline constructed there to voice their opinion.
No doubt about it. I mean, he's Ecclestone is something else. But Ecclestone, he's not stupid. The guy knows he needs.
You know, NASCAR, one time, Michelle, Gene, you know, you jump in here in just a minute. But at one time, we were always that if you had a race, a NASCAR race or any race in the South, you better have Dale Earnhardt Sr. there, or nobody would show up. I think in F1, if those red cars, the Ferraris, don't show up, you don't have a race.
They're doomed.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, it's supposed to be every race you go everywhere around the world, the stands are filled with seas of red. I mean, obviously, when they go to their home track, it's an even bigger deal. But, you know, I clearly Ferrari is the engine that drives the bus, even though they haven't, you know, run up front in the last couple of years. But, I mean, just face it, that name, anywhere you go in the world, you say the name Ferrari, and somebody's going to look up at you with recognition from the richest to the poorest country. So clearly it's a brand with power, and it makes perfect sense that that they have a lot of sway in what happens. And, you know, as I always go back to say, when you're dealing with billionaires, there's a hierarchy even there. And I think clearly
when it comes to Ferrari and it comes to Gene Haas, my sense tells me that his team would be basically a junior team, and though he's got Matt Borland as the technical director, I don't know at what level Matt Borland can handle Formula One. I would venture to say that Ferrari would begin placing people, in other words, strongly suggesting to Gene that he hire this person, and that he will end up being the Toro Rosso of Ferrari.
And why is that? And that's not a bad place to be. I mean, if you're going to play,
no, he wants to sell CNC machines. Yeah, I mean, he wants to sell CNC machines. That's his motive.
Right. And he didn't become a billionaire being stupid. And if you're going to – I mean, this is a game, again, where you can't be an upset. Richard Branson failed coming in. And that guy's flying in space right now. He's literally building passenger rockets. Okay, and the guy made $1 billion, and he started out promote Rolling Stones concerts when they were playing bars, and he could not succeed with all of his acumen and money and relationships and resources. So, I think Haas is definitely onto something from the standpoint that I just don't think you can come in and compete with a worldwide auto manufacturer at the highest form of racing, and I don't care how unless you're ready to lose your $1 billion fortune. There's no and. You don't get to be a billionaire being stupid. So
was just bored. It was not his gig. That's all. I mean, you really have to want to be in Formula One. You really have to really, really want to be there. I mean, Mercedes wants to be there because they want to win a few championships and then they'll bail. They'll take off again. Hey, see what we can do? They've done it time and time again throughout F1 history. They've come in, they've left, they've come in, they've left. Who's the one that's been there all along? Ferrari.
Absolutely.
Ferrari, yeah.
So I would have to say that I think Haas is probably going to end up being a junior style team if Bernie Ecclestone and the FIA go along with this customer style chassis, because that's what he's talking about. I mean, his last statement on the subject was, it's insanity the way they run the series. No startup team can come in and build their own chassis. All right, well, he's talking about building these chassis in North Carolina. And if he's going to build carbon monocoque chassis in North Carolina, where is he going to get that information? And how close to a Ferrari chassis is it going to be? It's going to have to be awfully close. I mean, unless it's just an out-and-out customer car. And somehow Formula One or FIA and Ecclestone allow that to happen. If that's the case, you know, you may end up seeing Mercedes may not want to offer their chassis. I mean, it may be one of those things where you can or can't. I honestly don't know. It's one of those things where if you don't have a microphone hidden in the boardroom and actually see what goes on, which is probably pinochle, you don't really know what's going on in F1. You know, it's just that closed, and it's just that Machiavellian. The Borgias, they were amateurs. I mean, this is a whole new league of people here. It really is. So what, you know, just for a brief moment, let's just talk about these sports cars. Because what it is and what interests me the most right now is what they call the LMP3 class. You've got the big prototypes, which is LMP1. They run Le Mans. They're the big manufacturer cars, 700 horsepower of torque. I mean, just dynamos, and they're hybrids. You take a step down into LMP2. Those are an extremely attractive class, very fast. Not as fast as LMP1, but extremely competitive, very fast, and you've got a lot of entrants for that throughout. And that's where the Tudor series is headed, is towards the LMP2 style car that conforms to the Le Mans rules. The LMP3 class is designed in Europe to take over for what they call the I can't quite remember. It was a Le Mans. The United States, it's PC, and I think that eventually that the PC class in the United States is going to give way to LMP3. We've got Tony Avi and Riley Engineering that are building an American LMP3 car. Orica engines. They're 450 horsepower. They have to use a Nissan engine. But Sebastian Loeb in Europe, he is building one. So is Sora Composites, which is Pescarolo, which I remember quite well, and I'm sure, and I think you, Henri Pescarolo, you probably saw him race at Le Mans, Bill. There are a lot of manufacturers that want to build these LMP3 cars, And one of the reasons, I didn't realize that the business model, the cars fall within the price range of these people that can afford to go out and run track days. They will rent, you know, a whole group of people will rent these tracks, and they'll go out with their Porsche GT3s and what have you and do nothing but just drive their cars. They're going to offer the LMP3 car, probably with some reduced horsepower, to these people. So these guys are going to have full-bore race cars to go do track days with.
Yeah, Michelle, as I'm looking, I'm really getting excited about these sports cars. And when you look at the LMP3 entries, and, you know, Roll Centra is coming back with this Jannetta Juno. And I mean, these things look like little spaceships. It's a prototype body style, closed cockpit. It looks like it's going to be at a, relatively speaking, an affordable price point for the well-heeled individual who has some discretionary income and doesn't mind dropping 10, 15 grand for a weekend to go out and play. I think it's a fantastic car, and I think it's going to play well in the States. I've been cruising through the Sports Car 365 website and the IMSA website, and I think this is going to be a fantastic series. I just love
the
look of
these cars. Well, see, that's almost proof of concept, because you're a guy that loves auto racing. You know more than a casual fan, and Bill and I know much more than a casual fan, and we're excited. We're both excited to see prototypes coming back. We don't care. I mean, okay, they're not the 956s, the Porsches that we saw in the past. It's not Can-Am with a 1,200 horsepower engine and a Porsche, but it is still, these are still gorgeous, purpose-built machines, unlike the DPs, the Daytona prototypes. They're phasing out, and what in 2017, we're going to see cars that can go back and forth between the continents and race in the World Endurance Championship or race in the two-door series. I think that's a good thing. Bill, what are your thoughts?
I think I agree with you, and I think that they're going to be affordable. Even the P2 cars, I think, are going to be affordable for the guys that play that game. I'm looking forward to people who run all the races in the United States, plus go over to Europe, run the 24 Hours of Le Mans, maybe the Spa race, and then go on to Asia and run the 24 Hours in Asia. That would just be worldwide competition and be a real shot in the arm for sports car racing. I remember, you know, when I first started going to races, the sports car races were the best things in the world. You got to see the MGs and the Triumphs run, and they worked up to more and more, you know, pure racing cars. And you don't see that anymore. There's no reason to go at. There's no excitement. These cars are going to bring excitement back to the table. By the way, Michelle, I've got some pretty detailed pictures from test days at Sebring last year on one of the P2 cars. I'll provide those to you if you want to put them on one of your websites for people to peruse.
Oh, twist my arm.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to see those. Do that before the day is over. I tell you guys, as we come to the end here, and I'm looking at the clock, I just want to jump in real quick. I know we got Sebring coming up relatively soon, and as you said, we got the season.
We got the 24 hours of Daytona first.
We got 24 hours of Daytona first. We got Sebring coming. We got some real exciting racing. I am just excited for 2015. Personally, professionally, and definitely looking at the new things that are going on in race cars. I was a little quiet tonight because sometimes it's really just a pleasure for me to sit back and listen to guys who really, really know what they're talking about. It reminds me of as a kid when I go to the airport with my dad at his flying club and just listen to these guys who flew all these planes that I looked at pictures of. So while I may have been a little quiet tonight, I was kind of a fan and a listener. But I just want to thank you, fellas, and tell you I'm excited about the new year. I know as the season kicks in, we're going to have a lot of fun stuff to talk about, and really, really looking forward to it.
Well, here's the thing. We all love auto racing. I grew up in it. Bill grew up in it, and you've grown into it. So that is, to me, a perfect combination, and I think it's going to get better. It's going to take some time. But I truly am excited about the prototypes, and I'd love to see what Tony Avi can do with Riley's design, an American-built car, as opposed to the Honda or the or the Pescarola or the Loeb car. I'm really interested in seeing that happen. At the end of the show, I'm Michelle Rahal, along with Bill Marlowe and Gene Boyer. Join us next week, and we're going to continue down the path of finding out who's doing what and doing it to who and why. And this is Motorsports Unplugged, and guys, we'll see you next week.